Evening, everybody. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
You know, what a drive. I ain't got a clue what I'm going to say yet, but God's going to show me here in a minute. We'll get with it. The y'all didn't know Santa Claus is going to show up for your meeting before Christmas, did you? Yeah. I am truly, truly grateful to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I appreciate it. It's an honor. Not just an honor, but it's an obligation. If it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know where I would be right now. I'm not confused that I owe a debt. No matter how long I live, there's no way I can repay y'all for what all y'all done in my life. I'm not a bit confused about what I've got. I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. It's not alcoholism. It's alcoholism. It's alive and well. And I've worked real hard at trying to understand what it is I'm dealing with. There's a thing that I call it the gift of desperation. At the end of my drinking, I was 27 years old, and I was begging God, let me die every day. I had a good job. I had a nice home. I was a single parent raising two kids. I had a nice car, had a motorcycle, boat. I worked for Reynolds Metal. I made good money. I was an entrepreneur. I sold herbal substances. And I couldn't pay my light bill. And I couldn't understand why. I'm pretty good at math. And I knew there was no way I could spend that much money. But I was. It's funny because, people... As a general rule, I'm pretty much a happy drunk. And people would say, I looked at my yearbook after I got sober from high school. And all through it was people would sign it. I don't know if y'all do that here or not, but people would sign your yearbook where I came from. And it would be, Jim, you're a really great guy. You ought to watch your drinking. And it was like little things about drinking all through there. My first wife I met in high school. I got married right out of high school. And she made me promise I would quit drinking before she would marry me. And I never knew I had a problem. And the funny thing was, I didn't have any problem quitting. She said, if you don't stop drinking, I'm not going to marry you. And I said, that's it, I quit. And I did. And it was simple. Nothing to it. And that marriage lasted 2 years, 1 month, 2 days, and 10 hours. It's a wonderful marriage. And I started back to drinking. And I picked up some of those other. I am a chemically enhanced alcoholic. Let's put that away. And I started some enhancements to add to the mixture. And I did that for a couple years. I had a cousin who was wild and crazy. In those days we called them playboys. It's not really a popular term anymore, but. He's an electrician, and he was running the streets, running wild, and all of a sudden one day he just quit. Started dating one girl, got married, bought a house, settled down, and I asked him. I said, "What in the world happened to you?" And he said, "I got involved with this church, and I'm riding motorcycles. I'm having a ball, I got curious, and I got checking out this church, Next thing I know, I kind of liked this church, and they didn't believe in drinking, so I quit. And I didn't have any problem with it. I gave sex, drugs, rock and roll, sold the motorcycle, took the money from the motorcycle, put down the house, bought my first home. I was like 23 years old. I had no problem with it. About 2 years in this church, I went to the leader of the church and told him, I said, because most churches are, it's really family oriented. I was a single parent, and I said, I really need to find me a wife. And he said, why don't you date one of these girls in the church? And I said, do you know where I come from? I couldn't date these girls. I'd corrupt them. And what fascinates me about that is I was doing what the church said to the T. Because I'm an alcoholic. Whatever I do something, I do it 100%. In my mind, I still wasn't good enough for those people. No matter how well I really lived, my mind said, I'm dirty, I'm worthless, I'm no good, I will destroy these girls' lives. And he had a good idea. He said, because I was doing missionary work at the time, and he said, why don't you go meet you a girl outside the church and convert her to the gospel and get married? And I thought, well, that's a great idea. So I went to the Godfather Lounge. That is the only place I know to meet women. And I met me a fine woman the very first night, and by sunrise, her and I both were drunk. But this time, it was different. You know, this time, I don't know what it was. It was like there was a passion involved with this drinking thing, you know. And after about a month of chasing her and alcohol, and I came back to church and told them what I was doing. They said, well, quit. Come on back. And my life was great. I had bought my first home. I bought my first new car. My kids were doing good. I had money in the bank. And I loved the church. And more than anything in the world, I wanted to come back to church. But I couldn't quit. And I didn't know why. I didn't have a clue what was wrong with me. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never met anybody who got sober. Everybody in my family, they had this problem. They died old and they died as bums. And all I can think of is I'm going to die a bum on the street and my kids are going to hate my guts. And and slowly over the next couple of years, it started what it does. It got worse and worse and worse and worse. And until it got to the end where I call it the gift of desperation, where I was begging God to let me die. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, I thought I was doomed to be my uncle's, and all I could think of is I'd have to do this for 40 more years. And I was begging God every day, and I mean every day. You know, at first I asked him to help me stop drinking, and after a while that didn't work. And then I begged him, if you couldn't let me stop, just please let me die. And I would wake up every morning in the two loneliest times in my life was nighttime. And I'm sure most of you have probably experienced, there's a loneliness that sets in at nighttime that nothing will take it away. I don't care if I was alone or with a whole group of people when I passed out. I was as lonely as a human being could possibly be every night. And the only thing worse than that was waking up in the morning and realizing that I lived through the night and that I'd have to do this crap all over again. And I knew that today would be just like yesterday. And the day before that, and the day before that, and the day before that, as far back as I can remember, with no hope. You know, I did not know what was wrong with me. I thought I was possessed by the devil. I mean, I thought because I was active in church and I messed up, that Satan had gotten my soul. And I don't know that's too far from the truth. But, and the funny thing was the way this all started off was I had my first drink at 9 years old. And my mama gave it to me. It was a glass of homemade wine, and she taught me a little saying. It was from my little finger to my thumb. If I don't drink it all, I'll give you some. And I chugged that glass of wine down. And every time I tell this story, I could feel the burn. It just burned all the way to my toes. And I'm sure I didn't get drunk at 8 or 9 years old, but it did something to me that day that I will never, ever forget. It was the first time in my life. You know, it's like I could breathe for the first time. Like, whew. It was the first time that I did not feel like I wasn't good enough. It was the first time that I felt like I belonged somewhere. It was the first time that I was enough, period. It fixed all that crap in my life. And alcohol did that for me for a long time. I had a lot of good days drinking. I've had a lot of fun with it. And then one day it just quit. And it quit working. I had a guy tell me one time that he believed that you're born with 5,243 good drunks. And once you use all them good drunks up, all the rest of them are going to be bad forever. And that's exactly how it felt. It's like I crossed this line sometime during that time I joined that church. And when I went back to drinking, it wasn't fun no more. It was all over with. The party was over. It was a full-time job. And I thought that's the way I would have to die. And I ended up going to a counselor at work, employee assistance counselor, not for the drinking, but for the living problems, because I had it figured out. I had my whole world was collapsing. I had, y'all understand, I had problems, real problems. I had a girl that I couldn't stand, that I was trying to get her to leave me alone, and she turned up pregnant. How dare her? I just, you know, and it just went on and on and on. And I went and saw this counselor for my problems, and he asked me what was going on, and I told him what was going on. He just kind of shook his head, and he said, excuse me. He said, do you drink? And I said, well, sure. He said, how much do you drink? I said, I drink socially. He said, what do you call social? I said, I drink a fifth every night. And see, the problem is, for me, that's social. That's all. I've always drank that way. From high school, that's the way my family drinks. It's, you know, I didn't know that wasn't social drinking. And in the end, I bought a fifth at 8:45, and I drank that thing before I went to bed every night. And it was purely medicinal. I found that at a fifth of early times and about 50 milligrams of Valium, I could pass out about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I had to be up and go to work at 7 in the morning. So that's how I existed the last couple of years. And then he asked about them other substances, and I started off with the legal ones. And I had a couple of different doctors. And I just, like, once I got started, I just couldn't shut up. I just dumped it. And he told me something. He said, you know, you ever thought that maybe you got it backwards? Maybe instead of trying to solve these problems, maybe you just quit drinking, these problems would go away. And it's like the light went on, like, bling. You know, never occurred to me. And I said, well, what can I do? And he said, you want to go get some help? And I said, you bet you. And he said, I told him, I said, I'd do anything. He said, go home and pack your bags, and we'll see you to the hospital tomorrow morning. And I'm going tomorrow morning. Not tomorrow morning. This was Tuesday. My birthday was Friday. And he was one of us. And he said, well, will you be there next Monday? And I said, you betcha, I'll be there next Monday. And he said, go have a good party. And I did. And I stayed drunk all 4 or 5 days in a row straight. And I went to that treatment center. I have the distinct privilege of being, I don't know if any of y'all, this was 1980, and I was the second group field treatment center in Goosen called St. John Vianney over on River Road, and it was a Hazleton-style treatment center where you did all first 5 steps before you came out, and in 28 days, they never took me off the first step. They never pushed me. I saw my counselor one time. After the first week or 2 weeks, they brought a psychiatrist in and did a full psych eval on me, and they left me alone. And I was glad. Cause they had these things called group sessions. I don't know if any of y'all have ever done those or not, but they they told me my first day is that, you know, we have these group sessions. You don't have to go the first day. You can just stay here and eat and watch TV, or you can come. It's up to you. And well, everybody got up and went to group and left me by myself with my brain running. And I said, well, that's not good. So I walked down the hall and I found one of them rooms. And I walked in one of the rooms and sat down. And the spiritual advisor for the treatment center got in this guy's face and started calling him started cussing at him and telling him he was a no-good, worthless drunk. And he could kill his mama when he was driving, and got all up in his face and screaming at him and stuff. And the guy jumps up, takes his chair, throws it against the wall, and says, screw you, I'm out of here. And out the door. And I'm going, whoa, the hell is this? And I thought, well, he just must have walked in on something, you know. And then he went to some old lady and got in her face and started yelling at her. I went, so I come out of there, and I asked the guy, I said, do we do this every day? He said, no. I said, thank God. He said, we do it twice a day. Man, I was done. My mind was so messed up when I went to treatment, I was fried. My brain was completely fried. We studied Alcoholics Anonymous and had speakers come in and discussion groups in the treatment center when I was there. when I came out, they told me I had to go to AA meetings, and I don't know how to even describe to you how messed up my brains were. That although intellectually I knew kind of what it was, I didn't comprehend it at all. I walked to my first AA meeting up in Hopewell, Virginia, on Saturday night, and I was 28 years old. I just turned 28 in treatment, and it was like four old men by my daddy's age, and that two old women. I rode up on a motorcycle, I rode in the driveway about half wide open, sliding sideways, throwing gravel on y'all's nice new cars, trying to impress you. And I walked in, and I cussed like a sailor. Sailors don't cuss that bad. At the end of the meeting, they all shook my hand, told me to keep coming back, and I looked them in the eye, and I knew they were lying. They were saying it, but they didn't mean it with a darn. And I walked out of that room, and I'm thinking, this is what I got to do to live. I'm in trouble. Because I don't know how y'all drank. I drank. There was a lot of excitement when I drank. The places I drank, well, they had a pizza place. We'd go get pizza from time to time, and it would give me the creeps. I would walk in, it was a bar, and it was lit like this. And it had a jukebox playing real softly in the corner. And people were sitting there with their kids, eating pizza and sipping beer. That's not where I drank. Where I drank, it was dark. The music was really, really loud. We used to talk about seeing the Friday night fights at the Kenwood. But we didn't have no TV. it was nothing to have to dodge a glass flying through the room. It would step over a puddle of blood as you come in, And that's where I was comfortable, in dark, seedy places, fun places. I later found out that excitement was not fun. It was very exciting. It wasn't fun. Fast cars, fast motorcycles, crazy women, a lot of rock and roll, lots of drugs and tons of alcohol was the way I was living. And I left that and walked in this room full of these people my parents' age. And I thought, man, I am in trouble. I had culture shock, my days consisted of I would get off work, take care of my kids, carry on to my sister's house, go to y'all's AA meeting, listen to y'all for an hour, talk about what's bothering me. I always had something bothering me. Come home, turn on the Waltons on TV. Yeah, it was Waltons. And tell myself, yeehaw, I'm loving this. And I would do that for a little while. When I was in treatment, they told me I had a disease of alcoholism. And that really sounds good. Because, see, when it's a disease, it's not my fault. I'm sick. Stop blaming me. Now, I didn't believe it for a damn minute. I would tell you I did it. I would tell myself I believed it. But the truth was, it feels like I'm just a low-life, weak-willed, no-good piece of garbage. And I just need to grow the crap up, get a backbone, be responsible, take care of my kids, and go to work and do what I'm supposed to do. That's what it feels like. And you talk about it being an allergy. And I've never had a rash from drinking in my life. Y'all were talking crazy. So I walked in one of my first meetings, and the guy said alcohol was not the problem. And I'm thinking, you've lost your mind. Why am I here? Alcohol's killing me. And there's a lot of stuff that y'all are talking about. I just didn't make sense to me when I was first here. What happened was this is the neat thing. The one thing I got was that whatever alcoholism is I've got it. I have never once doubted that whatever it is, I've got it, and I've got it bad. And I understood that Alcoholics Anonymous is where I'm going to get my life saved. And I found out I don't have to like you. This is not a social club. You don't have to like me. And I'm all right with that. And if everybody likes you, Somebody's lying, I think, but the, because that's why they got chocolate vanilla ice cream. We don't all like the same flavor, you know. And the insane thing to me was, is I without a doubt in my mind ever, I understood the deal that if I put one of anything in me, I may never get sober again. You know, and it's not the dying. It's the thought I might live 40 years drunk. You know, my last uncle died, and I went to this memorial service because they cremated him, you know. And the only nice thing they could say about him was that somebody had said at one time they had heard he was a pretty good body offender man. That was his whole life. That was it. And when it was through, one of my cousins looked at his other brother and said, "Thank God that rotten sucker's dead." That's not their words. And when I was drinking, at the end of my drinking, I knew that was my future. I knew that before it was through, everybody in my family was going to hate my guts. I had two brothers that already threatened to kill me if I messed with their kids ever again. Their kids were teenagers, and I may have influenced them a little bit. And they weren't happy with me. Knowing that if I put anything in me, I risk living that way, I drank six more times. And I never stopped coming to meetings. I've been here since June of 1980. I ain't been sober that long, but I've been here since June of 1980. Because one thing I understand is this is my solution. And y'all are not running me off. It was a meeting in Petersburg I went to, and the guy asked, "They might have a problem." And this guy says, "Yeah, I've got a problem." And he said, "What is it?" And he said, "Well, look around. What's different about the meeting?" And he said, "There's no women here." "You know why there's no women in this meeting?" And he pointed right at me. He says, "Your nasty mouth. The women were driving from Petersburg to Richmond not to sit in a room with me and listen to me and my profanity. It was that bad." I didn't cuss because I wanted to. I just didn't know no other way. I was hurting so bad inside, it just came out my mouth. It was just self-hatred. The neat thing was once I did that fifth step, that didn't go away, but it got a heck of a lot better. And that's how I came in here. And people, I'm sorry, but y'all weren't real thrilled to have me in your meetings. You weren't. But y'all welcomed me anyway. And the neat thing was that I understood that this is where I've got to be. I'm not confused. And when I was in treatment, they introduced me to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess I'll get on that now. And when I saw that fourth and fifth step, I made a firm commitment they had a marble statue of Jesus in the chapel. And me and Jesus had a talk one night. And I'm dead serious about it. I told him that he knew what I had done, and I knew what I had done. And I don't ever remember reading anywhere in that book that said I had to tell you a darn thing. And I wasn't going to tell y'all ever what I had done. And for 16 months, I stuck to that. 16 months and 6 white chips. five of them were little, I call them slippy poos. I went out and did a little something and scared me to death. I run back to the meeting, got a white chip, and started over again. But one of them, my head said, "We're going to do one, go get a white chip. It's going to knock the edge off, take this pressure off of you, and get a white chip, and we'll be good." And I did that, I wasn't good. I was at the liquor store the next night. And I thought, uh-oh, something's changed. And for the next 2.5 months, I came to meetings, and I drank. And I couldn't stop. And I kept thinking, oh, my God. Oh, my God, it's happened to me. It's got me, makes the hair on my neck stand up. I don't know if you ever thought about it. My first thought was, I got sober through church, and the church quit working. And I thought, what if AA is like church? What if it won't work for me now? And I don't know if you ever thought about it or not, but you know, if this doesn't work for you, you're screwed. And this is it. You know, I don't know of any other way to go. And I came to meetings for 2.5 months, and I didn't come into meetings drinking. But the problem was our meetings were from 8 to 9. And the liquor store closes at 9 o'clock. And so there's a dilemma involved. Is that I didn't think I could make it through the night without drinking, but I was hoping that somebody would talk me out of it. If every night at 7:45, I'd go to the liquor store and buy me a fifth, put in the car, go to my meeting. If when you asked me, I would tell you the truth. And y'all would tell me stupid stuff like, why are you wasting our time? Why don't you get out of here and get finished up? Yeah. Obviously, you're not done yet. You know, and I would tell you this, don't ever tell Homer that. This is a life or death situation. If they're in this meeting, if one of y'all in the meeting and you're drinking, welcome. Don't let nobody run you off. You're welcome here. You belong here more than anybody I know. When I went through those meetings, I was desperate. I begged God every day to help me get stopped again. I came to those meetings with praying that somebody was going to say something that would help me find a way to quit drinking. Because this is life or death. And I don't want to die a bum. And I don't know exactly what happened, but at 2.5 months, I found a jumping off point where I ran out of drugs and alcohol at the same time. And I got sober. And I found me one of the sponsors. And then the sponsor thing, I will tell you, they told me to get a sponsor. Right out of treatment, I had this old guy who was giving a ride to meetings. And he was a really nice guy. And I asked him, would you sponsor me? And he said, Jim, I would like to sponsor you, but I've got too many guys. I said, okay. So about a week later, I ran across another guy, and I talked to him. And I said, would you sponsor me? He said, Jim, I would like to sponsor you, but I've got too many guys. And then the third guy said, Jim, I'd love to sponsor you, but I've got too many guys. Now, I'm not brightest candle on the cake, but I'm smart enough. There's like 15 of us in meetings, and 3 of them got too many guys. Somebody lying. And what I found out later on is everybody was scared of me because I was crazy. Y'all have no idea what an animal I was when I came in here. I come in here carrying a sawed-off shotgun hunting people. I had one feeling left. It was hate, just pure raw hate, and I hated everybody and everything. I said, there was no gravity. The earth just sucks. And that's the only reason we didn't fall off of it. And that's how I felt about life until I got here. And I was at this meeting one night at the last relapse. And it was my next to last relapse. And I got talking to this old short old Polack guy. And him and I was just carrying on. And I turned around looking. Everybody was gone. Looked at my watch. It was after 10 o'clock at night. And I said, Phil, would you sponsor me? He said, sure. And I had no idea what I got myself into. Phil was crazy as I was. they said there's a wrench for every nut in here. Yeah. And Phil was my wrench. And he cussed me every day for the first 2-3 years in this program. And that's not the way everybody gets sponsored. But that's exactly what I needed. You know, he knew exactly what was going on with me. He taught me spirituality. He taught me simple stuff. He said, Jim, when you were born knowing right from wrong. It's got nothing to do with morality, got nothing to do with society. When you drew your first breath, you knew right from wrong the very first day. And he said, every time you've done something wrong, you knew that crap was wrong. Every time. He said, if you'll just stop when you go to make a decision, and ask yourself, is it right or wrong? And listen to your gut feeling. You'll know what to do. And he said, after a while, that will become instinctual. And then what can happen is the door will open up to where you start getting those little thoughts, intuitive thoughts, not whether it's right or wrong, but hey, just let's go here. And he would do stupid stuff with me. We would go to meetings. And my first time I got introduced to that was we went to a picnic in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. And he lost his driver's license, so I had to give him a ride to every meeting, so I was stuck with him. And he always went to meetings out of town. So I had an hour to get my butt chewed all the way to meeting every night. And we got halfway to Carolina, and I said, well, where's this meeting at? And he said, I don't know. And I about lost it. I said, what? You don't know? He says, God will show us. I said, you've lost your mind. He said, no, I'm telling you, you got to learn to have faith. He says, God is going to show us where this meeting is. I'm watching the gas gauge, seeing all the money I'm wasting. And we went down, I got off the off ramp at Roanoke Rapids and pulled down the road, and he says, take a right up here. And I took a right. We rode a little ways, and he said, I think you need to take a left up here. And he just, we zigzagged around. He said, there they are. That was the days when we had bumper stickers. And there were the cars with the bumper stickers, and the guys out in the yard smoking cigarettes. And there they were. He said, see, that's trusting God and having faith and doing the right thing, and God is going to take care of you. And that would be cute if that was the only time he did that, but he would do that on a regular basis to me. And we'd go up to Richmond this time of year in the dark, and he would say, I said, well, where's the meeting? Well, I don't know. And we'd always find the meeting. And what he did for me was he taught me that God is always there talking to me if I just slow down and calm down and listen to him. When I had that last relapse, on October the 2nd, I'm trying to get this right now, October the 1st, 1981, I went to 3 meetings. Phil gave me a list of things to do. Every morning I was to get up and ask God to keep me sober. I had to read, had to go to a meeting every day, and that consisted of a one speaker meeting, a big book meeting, and a 12 and 12 meeting, and the rest of them were free, whatever I wanted to go to. But I had to go to the meeting every day. I had to call him every day. I found that if you don't call Phil, Phil calls you, and that's not nice. You best call him. And I had to get phone numbers at every meeting I went to. And he said, if you go to 90 meetings, you get 90 numbers. You got no excuse if you get in a bind not be able to call somebody. And I had to call one of you up every night. And he told me, don't call the same guy every night because you'll wear his butt out. So rotate it. And what I found out from that was, I hated it. I hated making phone calls. Was I found there's a bunch of y'all I got nothing in common with. We call. I call. I say what's going on. The air goes dead. We hem and haw a little something. And I say thank you and I hang up. But there was like 5 guys that I met making them stupid phone calls that we became like soul brothers. It was like we call it a network now, but we just bonded like brothers. And man, we started going to meetings together and hanging out and doing cookouts and picnics and campouts. And I would never have met those guys had I not made those stupid phone calls. The other thing I had to do was I had to read that stupid book, this book, every night for 15 minutes. No, he said, no more, no less, that you're too stupid to remember more than that anyway, And I'm still too stupid to read much more than about 15 minutes. My brain's somewhere else. I got ADD real bad. And it was strange because I could open that book up and read one sentence and close the book, and I couldn't tell you a word in that sentence. And I'd call Phil, my book's the corner of the feet off, I throw it against the wall. I'd get frustrated. It didn't make sense. And I said, why do I got to read this book? I can't remember anything. He said, your brain is a computer. If you put it in there, it's there for God to use. If you don't put it in, he can't draw on it. He said, and you can't pull it up to feed your stupid ego. But when you need it, it'll be there. And I got a call from a friend of mine who came home after a meeting and found his door kicked in by 2 drunks he used to run with. There's a half gallon on the floor and 2 drunks passed out in his living room. And he said, you need to help me. I can't get these guys out of here and stay sober. So I came over and we took them boys home. And one of the boys started talking about wanting to be sober. And while we're at about 12 o'clock at night, while we're talking to this guy about being sober, I started quoting stuff out of that book. And we got back in the car and all of them. Boy looked at me. He said, I didn't know you knew all that. I said, me either. it freaked me out. It's like, what? It's like it was just what Phil had told me. It was that it, when the time came and I needed it, it just rolled out. It's like preparing for these talks. I don't prepare for them. I have never given this talk ever before. So we'll see where it's going. And After a few months, at the end of the day, I was supposed to get on my knees and thank God for keeping me sober. And after a few months of this, I caught myself thinking that I was, me and God had this talk in my morning prayer. And I said, well, I'm 29 years old. And my family, we lived pretty long. I would probably make 85 or 90. And I've been saying this prayer for right many days already. And it's getting really repetitive. And I got this great idea going. And I didn't tell Phil, by the way. And I asked God, I said, look, what if I just do this? How about if I ask you just to keep me sober till I die? And we don't have to do this every morning. And I thought that was a really good idea. But I didn't tell my sponsor I thought it was a good idea. And about 2 weeks later, I had been to 3 meetings the night before. I'm reading that book like you told me to read it. I'm making my phone calls. I talked to him. I talked to another person in the program that morning. I was cleaning my kitchen cabinets out. It was October 2nd, 1981. It was a beautiful day. My kids were out in the yard playing. People say a grateful drunk won't drink. I'm telling you, don't believe that. That's a lie. I didn't have a, what the big boy said, I didn't have a, on a cloud in the horizon. I was cleaning my kitchen cabinets out. There was Vegematics and the freezer pops and all that stuff you buy you never use. And I was throwing this stuff in the trash. And I pulled something out and a baggie popped up. And all I could think of was one of my old girlfriends had stashed something. And I pulled it out, and there was a little dust of pot in the corner of a baggie. And I got to laughing about it. How stupid. And I went to throw it in the trash, and this thing went through my head and said, it's been up there for 18 months. I bet it's good. And I stopped, and I looked at it, and I said, it looks like Red Bud. And I smoked it, just like that. And I went, oh, my God. Now, the worst part was I didn't get high. And I thought, damn. I done relapsed and didn't even get high. And I did that all day long. I kicked myself all day long. And I got 2 blocks from the meeting to get that last white chip. And this little voice in my head said, come on, you're not really going to get a white chip and not even deserve it. And I turned left instead of right and went to the liquor store. And Kaminsky just as drunk as I could get. And I ended up at the Godfather Lounge that night. And I danced the very last dance with this girl. And I want you to have God works. And I'm hanging on her. And I'm saying, baby, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm drunk. And I said, but I'll be all right tomorrow. I'm an alcoholic. And she smiled at me. She says, I go to Al-Anon. I understand. My daddy's a drunk. You know, what are the odds of going to a bar and meeting probably the only Al-Anon in that bar drunk? But that's a true experience that my last relapse. And I sat home for the next 3 days and tried to figure out what I did wrong. One thing I know about this program is if you work this program, you ain't getting drunk. If you get drunk, you miss something. I believe that to the end. And what I realized then, it was 2 things that I had missed. One was I stopped praying. Before my sheet comes off my head, me and God do the first 3 steps every morning. I am powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanned when I ask God, and most times I beg God, please don't let me drink today. And then I ask Him to keep my thoughts sane and rational. Because I realized that when they said alcohol ain't the problem, they're right. Because see, when I quit drinking, I got worse. I got much worse emotionally. And I became a very angry, hateful individual. And then I asked God to take my life and my will and lead me through the day. And what that looks like to me is that my life is my actions and my will is my thinking. If I've done that, whatever happens today is none of my business. And it's not good and it's not bad. It just is. And what I have learned is that the things that about killed me in my recovery were the best things for me. And the stuff that I thought was all I couldn't live without damn near killed me. And I know, so I've learned I don't know what's right, what's good, and what's bad. You know, I can't trust my judgment on any of that stuff. But what I do know is that I have a God. In that third step, one of the problems I found I had was I come up in a religious background. And people say, don't you believe God loves you? And I said, absolutely. Now, when I got honest after a while in the program and talked to my sponsor, what I found out was what goes on up here, and then it's really what you believe down here. Up here, I believe God loved me, and I believe he forgave me, but not so much down here. So they say God forgives you, but if you do this, you're going to hell. Now, my alcoholic mind locked on that going to hell part. I believe that God forgave y'all. I can see why he would forgive y'all. But God ain't never cared for me. At the end of my drinking, some of y'all talk about at the end of your drinking, you said, God, please take this away from me, and you never drank again. And that about pisses me off. Because I begged God for months. And he ain't helped me a bit. Well, he did. He just didn't help me right then. I'm here. I'm not confused. I guess he just knew I was too brain dead to get it that way. And what I come to realize is that when I got honest with his inventory stuff, what I realized is I've never felt like anybody cared about me, that I've always been a throwaway person. You know, my whole family's, I've come from a good family, but it was like, go away. You're bothering me. My dad never talked. When he carried me fishing, it's because he had to. He didn't carry me fishing because he wanted to be my buddy. Well, if I got to take him, get in the car. and what I found out was, I believe God loved y'all. I just didn't think he cared about, nobody cared about me. I still have a problem with that. Not God, but believing people can care about me. And I talked to my sponsor about that, and he said, well, let me show you some stuff. And this is where the inventory is so important. It's because we've got to deal with reality in here. It's what my brain tells me. And then there's reality. And see, in 73, I put a .32 automatic in my head and pulled the trigger. And the gun didn't shoot. And he said, who do you think that was? In 75, I ate a bottle of Valium and drank a fifth of Southern Comfort and sat down and partied with my friends and never told nobody. And I woke up early feeling good. And he said, who do you think that was? I've had guns in my face. I've taken guns away from people. I've had motorcycle wrecks and car wrecks. And he said, God has spent all these years doing his best just to keep your sorry butt alive. And you don't think he cares about you. And now you're here trying to do the right thing, and you think he's going to get you. And that's insane. And that was the turning point between me and God, was I started realizing, well, maybe God does love me. And it started working from then on, because then I got a higher power I can trust. It's kind of hard to trust one if you think going to spank you. Because if God is fair, I got a spanking coming. But I find that God is loving. He's not fair. Thank God he's not fair, because I'd be in real trouble. The other thing I realized that I hadn't done was I've never done a fourth and fifth step. And that thing scared me to death. I'm living proof that you can do a fourth and fifth step and not like it, not understand it, not believe in it, and it will work for you. Because, see, I called my sponsor, and I said, I want to do a fifth step. And he said, have you done your fourth? And I said, no, but you give me a date, I'll have this damn thing done. Because I'm scared. And what I understand about this thing is that those who come in here and work the steps were happy. They were prosperous. They lived good lives. They didn't have it. They didn't keep getting drunk. They didn't have none of this crap I had, and I was tired. And I didn't understand it. I did not understand what telling you my secrets had to do with drinking. That sounded like a big. Where I come from, if you told somebody anything about you, you heard it for the rest of your life. And I thought y'all were setting me up with some kind of chump. I figured it was some kind of backroom stuff where y'all would sit around and whisper about what all your sponsees have been doing and make fun of them. After I had that last relapse, I didn't care no more. I didn't give a crap what y'all do with it. And I went, I sat down and I did my fourth step on a Friday night, and Saturday I went over to my sponsor's house and I told him all my, and I put the ugliest stuff down first. Somebody gave me a tip. If you write down your deepest, darkest secret first, you'll save about 40 pages of writing. And I wrote about 13 pages. I said a prayer, got on my knees, I said a prayer, got my pen, I started writing, and about 13 pages later, and I don't think about an hour later, I was done. It was through. And it wasn't the best four step in the world, but I have never had to do one since. And I'm sober. So what I did was, this is just me. I mean, I'm not knocking anybody's program by no means. But what I did was I got rid of all those skeletons in my closet that have been haunting me all my life. My head tells me that I'm worse than all of you. And if you find out, you'll never speak to me again. And all that, you will humiliate me forever. And what I found out by sharing my fifth step was it's a lie. Truth is, I'm a lightweight. Disease feeds off of secrecy and isolation. It says, shh, don't tell anybody. And as long as you listen to that crap, you're screwed because it's got you. And you'll be a victim of your disease the rest of your life. And they speak the truth, and truth will set you free. The big dark secret that I had that I was never telling anybody was I got molested at 8 years old. And certain people knew about it, and I got teased and humiliated for it. And I swore I would never tell nobody ever. And I just told y'all. Because, see, I'm free. I'm all right with it. It's just something that happened in my life, and it's not a big deal today. And two things happened was I started praying every day, and I did it. I did the steps, and I ain't drank since. That could be a coincidence, but I don't think so. And what I found out was in that fourth and fifth step that was so terrifying to me is that one of the problems I had was I believe that was a list where I wrote down all the terrible things that I was and what a rotten human being I am. And what I've come to realize through years in the program is that what that really is that, see, when I was a kid, my disease said I was no good, I was rotten, I was worthless. And when I took that drink, it took all that fear away. And when it took the fear away, I got courageous, and I did a lot of stuff I'm not proud of. And then the disease would say, see, I told you. I told you you were no good. And then I'd have to drink more. And then I would do worse stuff. And the disease would say, you are a piece of garbage. And when I did that four step, I was a piece of garbage. And what I know today is what that four step is, it's not of who I am, it's what my disease conned me into. It's not who I am. And I promise you, what you did in your four step is not who you are. And the reason why I know that is that I feel bad for it. If I didn't feel bad, that might be who I am. But the truth was I felt guilty and I felt dirty. And the reason why I feel guilty and I feel dirty, because that's not who my soul is. And when you get into that sixth and seventh step, what you do in that sixth and seventh step, Michelangelo or somebody said, how do you know where to hit the rock? And he says, I don't know. I chip away everything that's not the statue. And that's what that sixth and seventh step is. It's where I start chipping away all this bull crap that I have done that's not really me. All the lies that I have lived, all the stuff I've done that's not truly who I am. And it goes back to that thing my sponsor told me, was that when I get ready to do something, I ask myself, does it feel right? And if I do it knowing it feels right, feels bad, what I've done is I put another piece of phony garbage on top of me, and the real me gets buried deeper and deeper and deeper. The sixth and seventh step I was told is the guy goes to the doctor and says, doctor, every time I do this, it hurts. And the doctor says, don't do that. I can't use this arm, it hurts. And what the sixth and seventh step for me was, is I had to figure out what it was that made me feel bad. When I first got here, I lived a really rough and nasty life. And I didn't have, my pain tolerance is way up here. It took a lot to make me hurt. And as I stayed sober and kept praying, my pain tolerance got lower. And more this stuff started bothering me. The nasty mouth still bothers me. I've not conquered it yet. Me and God are working on it. And that's the other thing it says. It doesn't say I'm removing nothing. It said that God will remove it when it's time. And that's not a cop-out. Because when it gets uncomfortable, I wish he would hurry up. And most of my defects today, I don't, you know. And what I found out is if you don't do anything to make you feel bad, you don't have to drink anymore. You don't have to drink. Every time I do something that I know is wrong, it hurts my spirit. I was teaching school. I actually became a school teacher. And I was talking to one of my students one day, and he did something really bizarre. And I pulled him aside, and I said, look, let me explain something to you. I said, I went through my life, and I kept doing this little stuff that was wrong. And every time I do something wrong, I took a piece of my soul, and I threw it in the trash. I said, I woke up one day, and I had no soul left. See, that was my bottom. Alcoholism took my soul. It wasn't a financial bottom. It wasn't a legal bottom. I've never been locked up. You know, I've never had a DUI. I lost my soul. I hated me. And what the program has taught me was stop doing that stuff. And I pick a piece of my soul back up each time. And I say, I have never liked me. I have never wanted to be me. And for the first time in my life, I love me. There is nobody in the world I would rather be than myself. And I'm not any better than anybody else. It ain't about that. I was told I was ugly my whole life. And I sat in my house when they were 20 years sober and looked at a picture of me on the wall and realized it was a lie. And I was pissed. I was pissed. You realize, any idea what it's like to live your whole life believing you're one of the ugliest people in the world? And then realize it's not true. You carry yourself different. You go on a job interviews, you act different. When you go meet people, you act different. You know, and people tell you you're not ugly, you know they're lying. Until I realized I wasn't ugly. It didn't matter what you told me. Until I realized I was powerless over alcohol, it didn't make no difference what y'all thought. And today I know I'm powerless. My life is totally unmanageable. My life's still unmanageable sober. That's why I got a manager. You know? And I think I'm about done. So y'all have a nice Christmas.